Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
What you eat. Here's a clue. Why don't you take a peek beneath your feet?
Welcome to Local Food Connections, a show about the power of locally grown food to connect us more strongly with our communities and the lands we inhabit. Local Food Connections is brought to you by Local Food Connect. We're broadcasting from Wurundjeri country and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. We respect the enduring strength of First Nations people and acknowledge their long heritage of agriculture and care for the land in which our food is now grown. Today, we're joined by Elspeth Hay. Elspeth is a journalist, broadcaster, and author of her new book, Feed Us With Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food. The main contention of the book is that our current food system, with its emphasis on annual grains and industrial agriculture, is ecologically damaging and built on shaky assumptions, I think it's fair to say. Elspeth is a storyteller, so as she puts it, it's based on stories that are not necessarily true, that we all take for granted as true. So she challenges some of those stories, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Elspeth argues in the book that a healthier, more sustainable future lies in restoring perennial nut trees, like the Northern Hemisphere oaks, chestnuts and hazelnuts, as staple food sources. So there's a lot in common there with permaculture and with the thoughts of Bill Mollison on that too. Elspeth also hosts a great little radio show called The Local Food Report, which broadcasts out of the town of Woods Hole in Massachusetts, Cape Cod. The show, like this one, explores the local food movement, but Elspeth does it in a really cool little way by telling a little story of someone who grows or forages or cooks or has got some kind of contribution to the food movement, and then just gets their story and chats to them about what they're doing. And it goes for about 4 minutes, and that's what I just love about it. It's just a great little insight into somebody's life, motivations and contribution to the food movement. It's a really accessible, digestible little show. So but thank you so much, Elspeth, for coming on, and I should say welcome.
Thank you so much for the kind words about the show and the book. It's great to be here.
Okay, so before we talk about some of the shaky assumptions that or false narratives that our food system's based on, tell us a little bit about what motivated the radio show.
Yeah, I think I've always been really interested in how we can meet our needs from the living world around us. And I didn't see a lot of examples of that as a kid beyond the world of food. I think that was the most immediate pathway to connection with plants and animals and other species that were living around me. I had a really cool godfather who was planting peach and plum trees until he was in his late 90s and was still planting these fruit trees and tending a big garden. And when I started learning more about environmental science and getting interested in that, I got drawn into the local food movement as a way of sort of connecting what was happening with environmental issues with what was being, you know, put on plates every day in my house. So it was a really fun and tactile way to get involved.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's what comes across in your book. I think the way you've managed to connect a bunch of things together to make it's kind of like a cohesive sort of worldview, a new worldview or a new paradigm. So tell us, you make a lot about an insight that you had where you suddenly realize we're not separate from nature, but that we're obviously part of nature. We're in a habitat like other animals. Can you tell us a bit about the ecosystem that you're part of, Cape Cod, Massachusetts, because it's so different to where we're broadcasting from here?
Yeah, I live in, so I live on Cape Cod, which is this sand spit that sticks about 90 miles out into the Atlantic, and I'm almost at the very end. So there's only a couple towns past where I live. And the sand spit here was deposited by a glacier, and it's only about maybe 2 miles wide. So on either side of us is ocean. Actually, our radio station has this great t-shirt that says most of our listeners are fish. It always cracks me up. And the forest here is a lot of oak, mostly white oak, but also some scarlet and black oak and pine. So we have a lot of pitch pine and oak. And then there are all these kettle ponds in my town. So those are these depressions left by the glacier. And in those areas, we'll see a lot of other species, tupelo trees and maples and birches. And it's a really a lot of diversity for such a narrow place.
It
And
sounds
a lot
very,
of wind.
sorry.
Yeah, a lot of wind and salt and everything you'd imagine that goes with it.
It sounds to me like that nothing should be growing there, that the ocean should be sort of dominating it, but it sounds like you must have some deep soil.
Not really, no. What happened when Euro-American settlers first came here is they clear-cut basically my entire town. And very quickly realized that if you clear cut a sand dune, the sand just starts blowing away. And so then there's a big effort to reforest and to allow the land to grow back into forest. So there is a bit of topsoil. You know, there's some charcoal layers created by indigenous burning, which is something I got really interested in through researching the book, but not great soil in general, just a lot of sand. Surprise, so it can grow in sand.
It reminds me of Bill Mollison and David Holmgren's idea of the edge effect. That they talk about, there's a lot of diversity and a lot of fecundity where edges meet, and I wonder if that's something like what he's talking about there, the where the ocean's meeting the glacier and then this land, but and we don't need to go there. So you did mention sorry, what's that?
Makes sense though,
It
yeah, as
does,
a
yeah. So you have spent. Oh no, let's. Oh, let's talk about the indigenous food knowledge and what you've learned from indigenous people about that.
I spent some time when I was first researching the book, getting to know an indigenous medicine man and cultural biologist in California named Ron Reed, and he and I talked on Zoom during the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic because Karuk people, I learned, which is the people who he's part of in present day Northern California, have relied on acorns as a staple food for thousands of years. And a lot of that tending, I learned pretty early on from Ron, has involved fire, cultural fire and prescribed fire, which wasn't something I was really familiar with as a food production tool. But the more I talked to Ron, the more I learned from him and from other books and research I was doing that actually all over North America and all over the world, fire has been a really important agricultural tool for humans for, you know, basically since we became a species. There's some researchers who say that fire is what makes us human, our mastery of this tool. And so I got to go on some prescribed burns on Cape Cod, which were happening less than a mile from my house in an oak ecosystem here that I had just no idea that that was a part of my home landscape and also a really important tool for tending a lot of these keystone nut trees.
And now talk about we're rushing through this a bit, but we've only got half an hour and there's so much material, but talk about that, the role that humans have in the ecosystem. I mean, you talk about fire as being an agricultural tool, which is same, that was the tool that was used by Aboriginal people here.
Yeah.
Talk about who are we as a species in the ecosystems that we live in?
So I when I you know I think people in Australia are probably a bit more familiar with fire as an ecosystem tending tool than people in New England, where I'm from. You don't hear a lot about fire. But as I started learning about the history of fire and this relationship with oak trees, so oaks are usually fire adapted, most species are. And that means that in a lot of ecosystems, they actually really rely on human fire to stay dominant on the landscape. And I had always thought of oaks as a wild species, a natural species. And those words, if you look in the dictionary, those are words that by definition exclude human tending and human involvement. And the more I started learning about the history of people in different places using fire to tend these trees, the more I started to question some of the assumptions we have about what is agriculture and what is hunting and gathering. And the more those distinctions started to break down, as I got to know Ron Reed, he was telling me that fire acts as a fertilizer by recycling nutrients really quickly. It acts as a sort of pest and pathogen control. There's a beetle called the acorn weevil that gets into the nuts and kind of ruins them, and smoke helps keep those out and interrupts their life cycle. He was talking about fire as a way to control the water cycle in the basin, so to make sure that plants get enough water. Fire is a way to prepare the ground for acorns to sprout. So then, you're talking about preparing a seed bed, basically. And the more we talked, the more I was like, those are all the same jobs that a farmer's doing, right? Weeding, fertilizing, controlling pests and pathogens. And I started looking at sort of the history of those words, and they're actually really recent words, and have a lot more to do with scientific racism and, the past century of attempts to kind of paint hunting and gathering and agriculture as these different pursuits than anything rooted in reality. And the stories that Ron told me about the way that Karuk people have long tended the land always involved humans as a really positive force, humans as this really vital species to other species. And as he was telling me this, I had been thinking a lot recently about keystone species, because oaks in North American ecosystems are a keystone species, which means, for listeners who don't know, that they're as important to their ecosystem as the keystone in a Roman arch, right? So if you pull out that keystone, the whole thing collapses. And the more Ron told me about the history of the importance of human burning to so many other plants and animals in the Klamath River Basin where he lives, but also as I started learning in so many other places, the more I realized that what he was really telling me is that humans actually are a keystone species, and that traditionally in cultures all over the world, our main way of creating habitat for ourselves and other species is through fire, and that we have this really amazing connection with fire and this really important role. We're in the same category. We're called ecosystem engineers. So there's these different categories of keystone species, right? There's plants that make the food web hum. There's mutualists like bees. There's predators that control prey. There's prey that support the food web. And then there's ecosystem engineers. So, nobody would think a beaver is bad for damming and cutting and doing what they're doing. They're creating these wetlands. And even though today we're really used to the idea of humans as pretty negative in the environment, traditionally we have been the fire animal and this keystone species with fire. So that was just a complete paradigm shift for me when I got to know Ron and started learning this.
With the dirt, you'll observe it's certainly not inert. From a worm to a chicken, you're never alone on the loam, and it's time to get to work. We've been looking up, we've been messing around, we've been freaking out.
Want to know what happened at the 2024 People's Blockade of the World's Largest Coal Port?
Come along to a special 3CR screening of Turning the Ship, the short film that explains all, and be inspired to join the blockade this year.
Revisit the epic event and hear how this incredible people-powered protestival came together.
Join us on Friday, 19th September at Evil Thoughts in East Brunswick.
Head to Rising Tide Victoria Insta or Facebook page to RSVP and to get all the details.
Rising Tide Victoria is a 3CR supporter. Yeah, even Arnie in the 90s had a car that ran electric. They held back the tech. Shit, now it's gotten hectic.
Friends of the Earth Food Co-op is open. Get fresh produce and support local farmers and keep our grassroots community thriving through these unusual times. Organic veggie boxes and click and collect now available. Visit www.foefood.org/click-collect to place your orders. Or pop in store at 312 Smith Street and see how we're adapting with our new physical distancing layout. Shop organic and buy local. Made easy at Friends of the Earth. A proud 3CR supporter.
This is the Local Food Connection show on 3CR 855 kHz on your AM radio dial and 3CR on digital radio. You can also visit the 3CR website and listen to the live streaming of the show. Today I'm chatting with Elspeth Hay about her book Feed Us With Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food.
And as I learned more, I started looking at all these stories from different cultures all over the world, and so many mythologies and founding stories and creation stories involve humans getting fire as either a gift or stealing it. So that was just, you know, when I first learned we could eat acorns, that wasn't a rabbit hole that I expected to go down, but it has just been profoundly transformative for me.
Well, I'm so glad you went down it, because it just the phrase humans as a positive force is so what's the word? It's almost healing, just that phrase, because of the situation we're in at the moment and the on both sides of the, you know, the environmental movement and is very much focused, rightly so, on the negative impacts. And then the sort of techno science side of it's focused on technical solutions for the negative impacts. And what you're talking about there is just, it comes as a great relief and it is a paradigm shift. And I just want you to get that book out there and get more people thinking like this, because we just really need a positive narrative to move forward.
We do. One of the farmers who I spoke with for the book, a man named John Kemp, who's doing a lot of really interesting work with regenerative agriculture, he said something that has just stuck with me ever since. And that was that it's much more powerful to be for something than against something. And I think that the environmental movement for a long time has just been against this really long list of things. And even when we all agree, okay, well, we don't want to do that, it doesn't give us anything to move towards. And so I think we're in this moment where we need stories about what we're for and what we can do and how we can inhabit our role differently. Because when I was a kid, all I ever heard was what we were doing wrong and what we shouldn't do. And, you know, you look at kids today with anxiety and, you know, eating disorders and suicides. And I think we're really seeing the impact of our stories in our cultures. We're not giving young people much to move toward. And so I think that the more we can get out there stories of what we're for, you know, I've heard from so many people since writing the book who are like, okay, how do I get involved in fire? How do I do prescribed fire? How do I plant trees? And it's exciting to have these conversations about what we can do and how we have, you know, be part of the living world around us instead of separating ourselves from it to kind of like we're a disease and we're isolating it from us.
Well, that brings me to the next, you know, to be the devil's advocate, I'm going to be the person who says, hang on, we can't all just eat nuts. We're way beyond that. And we need industrialized agriculture to feed the world. That's the only thing that stops us all from starving. So can you address that? Tell a new story about that, please.
Yeah, well, the first thing I would say is there's really no data that backs that story up. It's completely fictional. I've believed that story my whole life until pretty recently. But when you start looking at the numbers, and I'll just go into two, little pieces of the numbers. There's so many different ways to look at it. But one is that most of the food that we say that we have to produce to feed the world, we're actually not eating. So if it's so important to produce this food to feed the world, you'd think we would be eating it. But a lot of it's getting, in the instance of corn, for instance, in the US, if you look at the USDA's own data, so that's United States Department of Agriculture, 45% of the corn we grow is fed to animals that would be doing better on pasture or some other landscape. About 40% is turned into ethanol. 15% is exported to other countries where it depresses their agricultural economies, wreaks havoc on local land policy, and actually results in more hunger than if we didn't send it. And less than 1% is eaten by human bodies in the United States. So we don't really need to grow that corn to feed the world. That's completely fictional. And then if you start looking at it another way, there's a really fascinating agronomist who I spoke with for the book named Ricardo Salvador. And he reminded me that when we talk about yield, we hear about some of this corn or soyland having these incredible yields, something that, when I was looking at nut yields, they could just never compete. We're forgetting that yield is a ratio. So the limiting factor when it comes to feeding the world is land. How much land are we using and how many people do we have, right? And growing food the way that we're growing it now in these industrial monocultures requires so many inputs from other pieces of land to produce this exaggerated yield on, 1 acre or 100 acres or whatever you're measuring. And it's in fact significantly less efficient in terms of land use when you actually make a proper equation for yield, which is what you're getting out for what you're putting
Put it
in. And
in.
when you do that in terms of acreage, it's much more efficient to produce land, to produce food, sorry, in a system that is a polyculture where you have a diversity of species. And there's all different ways to do that. Where I live, oak ecosystems are really effective. In Australia, I would imagine there's probably a different version of that. But what I've been telling people as I've spoken with people in different areas about the book is the fastest way that you can get into relationship with your place and figure out what a high yield agriculture system looks like where you are is to learn what the keystone plants are in your area, and then to figure out, what relationships are they in and what relationship have humans had with these plants historically. Because I guarantee if it's a keystone species, we have some historic relationship with it. And anytime you're nurturing and tending and, trying to create more of a keystone species on the landscape, by definition, you're creating more life. And more life is more food. And, we've made it really complicated, but it's actually pretty simple. The more alive an ecosystem is, the more food it's producing. And I think, I kind of grew up with the default assumption that like most things weren't edible. Most things, didn't have a human relationship. And researching this book has really reset that assumption for me. Now if I see a new plant, I think, I wonder what it is. Is it a food? Is it a medicine? Like, it's probably something. Do we weave with it? What's that relationship? And once we start to see the world that way, all these possibilities open up.
And possibly possibilities we haven't necessarily thought about in the same way that you had a bit of an epiphany with the acorns, didn't you? Tell
Yeah, very much.
us about that. Tell us that story.
So much so. I live in this oak forest, as I mentioned earlier, and in the fall, acorns are just raining down on my house. We have these friends across the street who come for the summer season and they live in a bus, and the bus is just getting pelted with acorns. They say it sounds deafening. And I just thought, well, those are a nuisance. We have to get them out of the yard. And maybe the turkeys are eating them or the deer, but not us. And someone sent me a link to this TEDx talk by a woman in Greece named Marcy Mayer. And she said that we could eat acorns and that they're a superfood. and that they're one of humanity's oldest foods. And I was just completely shocked by that, because all of a sudden this world that had seemed so separate from us humans seemed like maybe there was a little crack in that story and there was an opening for us, and maybe we belonged in a way that I hadn't really understood before.
Mm-hmm. Belonged in an ecosystem where the food's actually landing on our heads while we're importing food from thousands of miles away that's been grown very expensively.
Very expensively. And I think, you know, just to go back to the yield question for a moment, in so many of our conversations about yield, I think that we tend to confuse economics with ecology. And ecologically, these diverse polyculture, and especially where I am, agroforestry systems, produce much more food on mm-hmm. a per acre basis. You know, when you're looking at all the land required to produce the food, not just where it's growing, but any inputs. Economically, it may be very inefficient, but our economic system, it doesn't have natural laws like ecology. It's just a set of rules that we've completely made up. And on the one hand, that's incredibly depressing, because a set of rules that we've completely made up is basically destroying life on Earth. But on the other hand, we made it up. We can stop. We can unmake
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people, you know, when we get into these debates about yield or conversations about feeding the world, people tend to throw in these barbs from the economic side
mm-hmm.
and try to confuse the ecological side, because, you know, the ecological rules don't change, and they're pretty straightforward.
Yeah, and we're learning that. We're going to leave that there, because you've got to get back to your kids. It's bedtime in Cape Cod. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
That is all we have time for. My name is Anne Stanley, and my guest was Elspeth Hay, author of Feed Us with Trees, Nuts and the Future of Food, a book I can highly recommend if you were tantalised by some of the ideas that Elspeth shared with us. You'll love the book. Until next week, love the land you're on, share your surplus, and take care of each other. Stay tuned now to 3CR for more radical radio with Latin American Update. And if you want to support independent radio, please subscribe to 3CR. Bye for now.
With the dirt, you'll observe it's certainly not inert. From a worm to a chicken. You're never alone on the loam, and it's time to get to work. We've been looking up, we've been messing around, we've been freaking out.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.